League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
Independent thinking, unrestricted opinions. You're tuned in to the Killer Bees on ESPN 97.5 and 92.5. Live from the Veritex Community Bank Studios, here's Joel Blank and Jeremy Branham.
Paul Gallant in for Jeremy Branham. Joel Blank to my left. We all know that the Texans haven't exactly had the best history.
Just wait, what?
Putting it out there. I know. Perhaps the hottest take that's ever been laid on this show, and of course it came from yours truly. But there once was a time, allegedly, according to legend, where the Houston Texans could have had one of the greatest quarterbacks to ever play the game.
Go back. The man with the forehead you could show movies on?
That you could land a plane on. Yes.
Oh, that too.
You know, some would ask questions as to why he decided to send a couple of private investigators to home of person who was doing an investigation into why a package of HGH went to his house would wonder if the size of the forehead given
Where
Barry Bonds is related.
This?
But I'm going to move back.
Okay, Patriots fan, reel it in.
To talking about when Peyton Manning could have been a Houston Texan, because a lot of people believe that in 2011, Manning was open to playing for the Texans. The Texans said, nah. What's interesting about that is we've seen some rumors recently that were floated by one Dana White and not denied by Mark Davis that the Las Vegas Raiders were very much engaged in conversations to try and lure Tom Brady to Las Vegas to play for the Raiders. Gronkowski, Rob Gronkowski, would have been a part of that deal as well. But what happened at the very last second, someone stepped in. Much like it is alleged that Gary Kubiak stepped in 2011 and said, nah, we don't want to bring Peyton Manning aboard the Texans. It supposedly was John Gruden who stepped in the
Gary
way.
Gary Kubiak said, we already got a great quarterback. His name's Matt Schaub. How'd that work out?
It's coming off of a list. Frank guy's
known as pick
too.
Six.
Yeah, that wasn't good. But at the same time, you can understand why, right? I mean, he was coming off of a neck injury, nearly headless Peyton, like nearly headless Nick in Harry Potter. I mean, it was a severe injury. I think I can totally get behind a person having extreme reservations that this guy's ever going to be the same quarterback. And I think you finally saw the effects of that injury in the 2015 season where the Broncos, the year after they set all those records, Peyton Manning just wasn't the same. Didn't have the same arm strength.
He just fell off. And again, you didn't know when or why or how, but he did.
He fell off. And it fell off hard, and to the point where Brock Osweiler was playing quarterbacks. Another, well, unfortunate era of Houston Texans football. But what's worse? Is it Gary Kubiak saying no to Peyton Manning for the Houston Texans, or is it John Gruden saying no thanks to Tom Brady with the Las Vegas Raiders?
Well, I think that, you know, in retrospect, you don't know when it's gonna fall off. Everything's going to fall off the rails. But you knew that short-term, Peyton Manning was a genius as a quarterback, and it was exactly what the Texans could have been missing. It's like when you have the conversation of, do you want a top 15 quarterback, and then someone knocks on the door and said, we'll give you top five, top seven. Do you want to try and take the chance of upgrading and see what he's got left, or do you want to stay the course with the guy that's been giving you division title, AFC South championships, and a chance to put another division banner up, but not a lot after that? You look at it and you say, from a Vegas perspective, you were deeply entrenched in trying to figure out if you were staying or going in Oakland. You knew that with Gruden, he was the most marketable guy that your franchise had. But the minute that you got Brady and Gronk, you completely elevated everything. Your business, your tickets, your football. But Gruden's ego wouldn't let it happen.
Which is incredible, because Gruden has nothing to lay his ego upon. There should be no foundation. Congratulations. You won a Super Bowl with Tony Dungy's Tampa Bay team. Buccaneers.
That's right.
You were thought to be a snake and two-faced with the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. And I know this because I lived in Tampa Bay at the time, by just about anybody who played for the Bucs, who covered the Bucs after that went down.
I know guys that played for the Bucs.
Ask Keyshawn Johnson about John Gruden.
Oh, yeah.
He was very public about it from the beginning and deserves a lot of credit because a lot of people said that he was full of it and said, oh, it's a diva wide receiver. No. John Gruden has always been John Gruden, which is hilarious because John Gruden's brand was built up to such a high level considering the guy has done jack diddly, you know what, over the course of his tenure as an NFL coach.
Well, you hit it. The one time that he did win it all, he won it with somebody else's team. And then
that organization fell apart in the year afterwards, and then it became second-half collapse after second-half collapse.
He got $100 million for 10 years.
Unbelievable.
Because of the fact that he was a TV guy. He could sit down in a room with a quarterback, and he could draw some things up X's and O's so that Mark Davis got enamored and said, that's my guy. But then did you realize that your guy, with his track record in the locker room, was more of a cancer than he was a guy that could bring everybody together? And we talked about, from a coaching perspective, there's so many different ways you can be a successful coach. You could be a motivator. You know, you could be an innovator. You could do so many things. But Gruden took more credit because Keyshawn's running mate on the other side was Keenan McCardell. Keenan McCardell is one of my best friends. Keenan McCardell, I went to him after the fact and I said, did you, what? He goes, man, you know me. I never airing out dirty laundry, especially while I was still playing. But then when he started telling me stories and he was telling me what was really going on, then when Keyshawn came in and he kind of backed all that up, it's like, wow.
I mean,
the guy's persona publicly was so much different and positive than the people that actually played and for him privately.
It pissed me off so much because I remember, like, here he is, smiling his way through a Monday Night Football broadcast. And the whole time I'm like, he's talking everybody up. He makes everyone seem like they're the biggest star in the world. And if he were the head coach, he would be talking trash about all of these guys, including the good players. And John Gruden has always been obsessed over the course of his career with having a quarterback that I feel like he could control. Now, he deserves a lot of credit for helping Rich Gannon unlock the best Rich Gannon he possibly could, which culminated with, I believe, an MVP in 2002, which was, by the way, the year that Gruden had left to go to the Tampa Bay Buccaneers and results in that Raiders-Buccaneers Super Bowl. But after that, it was just a steady stream of Brad Johnsons and Chris Sims and Brian Greasy, a bunch of other quarterbacks who you never really thought had that much potential that he had as the one in charge. And then with the Raiders, it was Derek Carr, even though he never publicly committed to Derek Carr and always seemed to be throwing a little shade at Derek Carr.
As much as teams play musical chairs with quarterbacks, he was always enamored with somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
Always. He always looked at another quarterback.
But never a star, because he strikes me as the kind of guy, Joel, and you brought up that ego that thinks that he can turn a okay quarterback into a great one. And I think it all has to do with Rich Gannon. But Rich Gannon deserves more credit. I mean, because Rich Gannon probably was just a better quarterback and never was in the right system until he worked with John Gruden.
You think about it, too. His ego won't let anybody else get credit for his offensive innovations.
Yeah.
So he would hate it if he had a Manning or a Brady that when everything went well, it was their credit, not his.
Exactly. So I think if we're going to answer that question honestly, and you guys can help us out, 713-780-3776, 713-780-ESPN. What's worse, Gruden saying no to Brady or the Texans saying no to Peyton Manning? Look, that's bad, what the Texans did. But it's understandable given the context of the situation with the neck. I know that there were a lot of people at the time.
Paul, here's the bigger key. From a franchise perspective, you were still having success as the Texans. You were still winning division titles. You were getting to the playoffs. You were winning at least one playoff game.
You had just won your first division title. I think that was what was tricky about it.
But you knew you had a roster where you were going to win.
You felt good about it, yes.
The Raiders were trying to find their way. And so to try and find your way with a new coach getting paid a lot of money, the fact that you could take the greatest of all time and arguably one of the greatest tight ends of all time and do it from all across the board, business, on field, everything else stacks up for you. And then if you're going to Vegas and you know whether you're already there or you're on your way there with one more year in Oakland, you know what it will mean that first year to have everybody enamored with everything Raiders because of those three guys, Gruden, Gronk, and Brady. How do you not do that?
That's what I don't get either. Because, I mean, we're talking about Gruden not just getting in the way of having a better quarterback on the roster. He's getting in the way of financial gain. I mean, the Vegas Raiders with Tom Brady, Rob Gronkowski, party boy that he is, they become overnight.
You pay off Gruden's contract, maybe all of it, by the time this... And you don't have to win a Super Bowl.
Nope. And the Raiders will become a national brand, too. Mm-hmm. I mean, they've always been a weird, like, kind of national kind of fan base that's been behind them. And, yeah, he stood in the way. So, again, what the Texans did, in retrospect, not good. And I remember there were a couple of people. I think Jerome Solomon was the one that was banging the drum the loudest. Like, this is stupid. They're seriously not going to bring in Peyton Manning back about 10 years ago. Because that was when I was first starting to do sports talk radio in town.
Ridiculous that they didn't want him.
I at the time, and I was wrong on this, but I understood it. I thought to myself, look, I don't know that he's going to be the same guy again. And I was wrong. He proved everyone wrong 2012, 2013, 2014, 2015, to a lesser extent.
Yeah, but they won a Super Bowl that year. Off, but yeah, when you have a 3-year window of Peyton Manning at close to good, you know, the best Peyton Manning, how do you pass that up, especially when your quarterback is Kirk Cousins?
He is Joel Blank. I am Paul Gallant. Killer B, G's, ESPN 97.5 and 92.5, stepping in for Jeremy Branham. Congrats to Jeremy Branham on the birth of his son. He's on paternity leave. I am on speaking English leave. Coming up next, okay, what teams are most likely to improve in the NFL this coming season? Are the Texans one of them? We'll answer that for you next.
Razor-sharp commentaries delivered with a purpose. You found the Killer Bees on ESPN 97.5 and 92.5. Live from the Veritex Community Bank Studios, here's Joel Blank and Jeremy Branham.
Paul Gallant in for Jeremy Branham. Bill Barnwell of ESPN put together a list predicting NFL teams most likely to improve in 2022. Sadly, the Houston Texans are not one of the top five teams. That's the end of the segment. On, like, ESPN 97.5, 92.5.
How did they grade the level of improvement? I mean, if you're absolute rock bottom, you have to improve.
So Barnwell used a bunch of different statistical measures. I will say this about Barnwell. I think Barnwell puts a lot of work into knowing the numbers that are behind a team, advanced numbers.
He's big on it, yeah.
I will also argue I don't think Barnwell watches as much film as he comes across as he does. Whatever. We all have our own ways of comparing things across sports, and let's be also perfectly honest, no one is watching all 16 games of all 17 weeks of an NFL season.
Unless you do ESPN Radio.
Even then.
Well, you're not, but the rest of us are.
Yeah, sure, okay. Yeah. I think it's really funny when you hear someone say, like, I've watched every single game. Sure you have.
Well, I've watched every single game. I just haven't watched every single play.
Okay, fair enough.
I DVR them. I got a fast forward button.
Damn, bro, that's... No, I don't believe you.
Joel's a psychopath. He watches everything.
16 games a week, 17 weeks a year. Check that. 18 weeks a
Joel
year.
Joel said this morning while we were sitting in the bullpen... The Jets-Falcons preseason game was on replay. He goes, oh, I didn't watch any of that last night.
Like, I didn't watch part of that last night, but I wasn't paying a lot of attention to it.
He watches everything.
Yeah, I don't.
The only person that watched that game last night was Jake Asman because he cares about his Jets too much, and you like to torture him for it, which I think is extremely funny.
I mean, there is nothing more funny than when we went to Vegas. And we... We're waiting for Jake to show up for dinner, and he hadn't shown up. And I was just thinking back to as we walked to our flight out of Houston, where Jake told me, you just can't imagine a world where the Jets are better than the Patriots. And I said, you're right, because it's never going to happen. And then
Zach Wilson gets hurt.
Then Zach Wilson gets hurt, and you would have thought like someone in Jake's family had passed away. And look, he's a diehard Jets fan. We'll give him a lot of credit, and he puts in a lot of work into covering the Jets. But yeah, probably the only person watching that game. I said it to Brendan Riley already. Joel, watching 16 games a week, 18 weeks a year.
Yes.
Get help.
No, Brendan will tell you the same thing. When you're doing the job that we do, you have to watch.
You watch the important games.
No, I watch every game.
You don't have to watch every game.
I'm not on your side here, Joel. I'm with Paul.
You don't have to watch everything.
You don't have to know.
Watch the highlights.
It helps, but you don't have to.
Watch NFL primetime.
Wait to see how many of our intelligent listeners will come at you with something, and you go, what are you supposed to say? Well, I didn't watch that. I wasn't watching that at that time.
Well,
someone else would like to.
Here's where I am approaching this year on a real note before we dive into like the top five teams that have improved in Bill Barnwell. This year, I plan on branching out and watching more games, because one of the things about working for the flagship is like your whole Sunday is based around one team, and Jesus, it is
6 to 8 hours of it, isn't it?
Dude, I would be there at the Texans doing the, like, the pre and post and all that stuff. Like, I'd be there from like 10 in the morning to 7 o'clock at night.
Too much
for one team, especially when that team struggles, which they have a whole lot. But Bill Barnwell is looking at a couple of different statistics as far as to why you can expect an improvement from last year to this year. It's based off of the point differential, which he brings up a lot, the strength of schedule by DVOA, the turnover margin, which he also brings up a lot, because turnover margin is random in his opinion, and I think that his point differential number he believes is random, and that one year where you have a lot, it's probably going to come back the next season. So the teams that he have at the top, and there are some other statistical metrics that he uses, as far as the teams that are most likely to improve from last year to this year, the Buffalo Bills are number one. The Detroit Lions, Brendan Riley's Detroit Lions, are number two. Number three, the Baltimore Ravens, which I am a firm believer that will be the case.
They get healthy. They lost like five really good starters a year ago, almost every running back and defensive back on their roster.
They did. It was something else that they were even able to get to 8-9 last year.
How does the Buffalo Bills get number one when they were already too good?
Well, I get it, because I think this about the Buffalo Bills, Joel, going into this year. I feel like they are having a lot of air pumped into their tires. And there was a stretch in November where the Indianapolis Colts beat them like 42-15. And the New England Patriots beat them by throwing the football four times in a game. It was a weird weather game, so you kind of understand why. Mm-hmm. There was a stretch where they did not look good defensively. And okay, maybe next year they will be a little bit better.
So you add Von Miller and suddenly you go to number one?
They also are assuming that they will have a healthy Tre'Davious White. I think that there will be growing pains on the defensive side of the ball for the Buffalo Bills. I feel like everyone escalating them to de facto AFC favorite, I think you're putting the cart ahead of the horse a little bit. I don't think they should be clear and above everybody else. But Barnwell has them as the number one team.
See, I believe Brennan's Lions are getting better. I believe that with every draft, this is why I started the whole embrace to suck, right? When you get that many high picks and that many consecutive drafts, you have to at some point start hitting more than you miss and getting enough quality football players. Your roster gets better. You got a head coach that's psychotic, but it seems like everybody loves him and he kind of knows what he's doing. So I think that it's headed in the right direction. I understand that. I don't understand the Bills, because you really couldn't do much more than you've already did and already had in terms of getting better. And like you said, and they're already getting anointed because of a game they lost against the Chiefs.
That's what's funny.
Of being the favorite to go to the Super Bowl.
Their defense has issues. They could not stop the run last year. Von Miller's changing that. Just throwing that out there. Now, they did play without Tre'Davious White down the stretch. Tre'Davious White's one of the better corners in the NFL. Yep. He should be back, I think, at some point this year. I'm not sure
if he's ready to go. Ed Oliver from U of H is supposed to be doing a whole lot. He's been doing some. He needs to do more.
I think Buffalo's going to be at the same level as they were last year.
I don't disagree. That's not a bad thing either, but I just don't think they should be on this list.
I agree. Other teams on the list, and we mentioned the Lions really quickly. I agree with that. You mentioned the Ravens and all the injuries they went through last year. I agree with that. Number four, Denver Broncos.
Well, is that because of Russell, your boy, your favorite player of all time?
I got to say this. Like, if you've watched them in the preseason, Nathaniel Hackett, it wasn't that long ago. I think it was yesterday.
So you're not watching every game, but you're watching preseason.
I pay attention to the news. I just don't watch the games.
Mm. Oh, okay.
Yeah. Not in the preseason, man. The preseason is just too hard for me. Because I see some of the guys that are online that are covering, let's just say the people that are locally covering the Texans, whether it's training camp or talking about the preseason, and I'm just like, man, you guys are squeezing the sponge hard. I get it. It's your 100% focus all of the time. For us, it's different. We're talking about whatever sports we can, but I feel like this time of year, it's really hard to come up with any concrete opinions on things. I will say, though, the Broncos
is that head coach, just because of Russ?
Let me get back to it. The Broncos head coach apologized for their performance in the preseason game that they just played, which was against Buffalo, where they looked just awful. Awful in every capacity, and they look exceptionally shallow.
Nathaniel Hackett, ex-Packer OC, head coach of the Broncos.
He is the head coach of the Broncos now. Wilson is someone who in the second half of the year I think you have to keep an eye on, because Wilson's had some great first halves recently.
Always does that.
And last year was the exception, where at the beginning of the season, it's kind of weird.
But he was hurt.
Well, then he got hurt. It wasn't just the injury last year.
I mean, I was astonished when I found out he never finished in the top, two or three for MVP voting. Almost every year for a stretch of like 5 years, first half of the season, he was the leading candidate to get it running away.
You're 100% right. My 2 years there, I mean, 2019, I thought Russ was one of the top two quarterbacks in the game. 2020, first half of this year, felt the same way. And I had a lot of respect for him as a player, and I still have a lot of respect for him as a player. The human being, is kind of annoying. But I wonder about just how good he still can be. So, look, Denver should be better next year. I don't think Denver's going to improve leaps and bounds in the AFC West with a quarterback who is not as mobile as he used to be. That is the thing you got to keep an eye on. This was a guy who used to run figure eights behind the line of scrimmage, making people miss left and right. He is not quite that guy in terms of elusiveness anymore, and that was his biggest strength. And remember, 5'11" guy, you're under center behind huge offensive linemen. Russell Wilson's not exactly a guy who likes to throw over the middle of the field or throw it to things that are right in front of him. He likes to chuck it deep, and he is a great deep ball thrower, one of the best that we've seen ever. I'm just saying, I'm not really buying into this idea that Denver's going to be that much better this year, even though it is a great move by Denver to get Russell Wilson away, though Russell Wilson did force his way out of town.
Look, I think that you're talking about a Super Bowl caliber defense no matter what. They had a really good defense a year ago. They still have a really good defense. So again, how much did you do to improve? You added the most important position on the field, but you don't know how good he's still going to be. And you gave up some young pieces in the process. Not that you gave up too much. But again, it's kind of like Buffalo, but maybe a tier below. They didn't have that much more they could do to get better.
Yeah.
You got Russell Wilson, so you get a golf clap from me, but I don't know that you could say that that's a team that made huge improvements, though it is at the most important position on the field.
They have a lot of talent. I wonder about the reserves. The last one of the top five. And this one is another one where I feel like we are so into the idea of change here that we are making something happen that isn't necessarily going to. I get that Urban Meyer sucked last year. Are we really going to blame Urban Meyer and Urban Meyer alone for all of the struggles of the Jacksonville Jaguars last year? All Urban Meyer?
Pretty close. Is
Trevor Lawrence's struggles?
Trent Baalke's not a great general manager. They overpaid for the free agents they brought in.
But at least they
got a guy that is, you know, again, when you talk about like what goes with peanut butter, no one thinks hot mustard, right? So when you bring in a guy as the number one pick in the overall draft in Trevor Lawrence, the last thing you want to do is bring in a dictator from college football like Urban Meyer. You want to bring in an innovative, offensive-minded head coach that can make him better or get him ready to play and get him as prepared as he can be, like a Doug Peterson. It's kind of like going from David Culley to at least a veteran head coach in Lovie Smith, only a step above. You went from the absolute wrong choice to at least on the path of a really good choice for the guy you're trying to develop.
I think as someone points out on the Twitch, he was onto something and kicking kickers. But this is my last question about this. Are you sure Trevor Lawrence is going to be the guy?
I'm not. Jeremy is more sure than I am. And Jeremy saw more good in him a year ago than I did. But a lot of that I will go back to and saying he had the wrong offensive coordinator under the wrong head coach.
Mm-hmm.
Now when you got a guy that could be, you know, I hate the term because it's used too much, but a quarterback whisperer, but a very innovative offensive mind in Doug Peterson that has taken multiple quarterbacks and made something of them.
Nick Foles.
I think that he has the chance to do that with Trevor Lawrence, but I don't think anything's a lock for me either with Trevor Lawrence.
I've had questions since college.
Okay.
I understand what all the scouts say. I get it. Tall, long, can move.
The hair.
I don't like the hair. Oh. He looks like a medieval page boy. There is something missing. I can't really explain it. But I just don't quite feel he's the dissector of defenses that you see from a lot of these other great quarterbacks. And, you know, I think that was always Andrew Luck's problem. Like, Andrew Luck, extremely, I think, smart football player that made some stupid decisions on the field. Like, Luck, off the field, one of the smartest quarterbacks we probably ever had, went to Stanford, all of that stuff. Giant nerd of a human being. On the field, made a lot of boneheaded decisions. Lawrence, I just don't really get the vibe.
Paulie, I think a lot of it, it's kind of Mahomes at Texas Tech. I think that when you look at it, face some adversity. You know, you talk about Trevor Lawrence from pre-high school all the way through. The golden child, the silver spoon in his mouth.
Clemson,
you know,
ACC.
Where do you want to go? Where do you want to play? It's your team. Do it your way, blah, blah, blah. When you don't face adversity, that might be what he's missing.
Up next, we're going to talk a little baseball with Bob Nightingale. Killer Bees, Paul Gallant in for Jeremy Branham, Joel Blank, ESPN 97.5, 92.5.
All teams covered. No talking points necessary. You're back with the Killer Bees on ESPN 97.5 and ESPN 92.5. Live from the Veritex Community Bank Studios, here's Joel Blank and Jeremy Branham.
Paul Gallant in for Jeremy Branham. To my left, Joel Blank. And joining us right now, we have Bob Nightingale. Talk a little baseball with us. Bob, what's going on?
Yeah, doing good. Busy day.
Yeah, definitely a busy day for us in Houston. We are going to see Carlos Correa now with the Minnesota Twins make his return to play against the Astros tonight. We obviously have a lot of hindsight now that we've seen a little bit of Jeremy Pena and that we have seen Carlos Correa in Minnesota. Do you think that's a move that the Astros are going to be regretting come playoff time, moving on from Correa for the younger guy?
Well, I mean, they knew it ahead of time. I mean, they could have had the same deal as the Twins did. But, you know, talking to Jim Crane, he didn't want to give the opt-out. He wanted more certainty. You know, if you give a guy $35 million, you know, he's allowed to opt out. You know, he gets everything. So I can certainly understand why the when the Astros did that. You know, they could have turned, I guess, to a different shortstop. And, of course, they had the right to do it again. I mean, if they want, you know, Correa should opt out. And I guess, you know, and they, you know, if they want to, they can actually listen and be on him again if they wanted to.
Bob, as it relates to the Astros overall big picture, everybody was on that Yankees bandwagon really hard for a majority of the season. And now it looks like the wheels were borderline falling off, though Yankees fans are getting a little excited because of the game last night. When you look at the expectations of a Yankee team that hadn't done, you know, won a World Series since 2010 and the way they were going, what are the ramifications if they don't do what they were doing at the start of the year? Is Brian Cashman finally in trouble? Is Aaron Boone going to be the fall guy?
I don't think so. Certainly not Boone. He just signed an extension last year after the season. They like him a lot. You know, if you want to blame anybody, you can blame the construction of the roster. You know, sort of that trade doesn't look good. Trading Jordan Montgomery's been lights out for the Cardinals. You know, for Bader, who still has Harrison Bader, who still hasn't played yet, still in a walking boot. But I don't think either one is in trouble. I mean, they're going to make the playoffs. They're going to win the division. But let's be honest. Even with the going great guns, and everybody's falling in love with the Yankees. There was one team that couldn't beat, and that was the Astros. I mean, they played seven times and never once came to the plate with a lead. You know, those two losses were blown saves. So I still think, you know, nothing changed my mind. The Astros are the team to beat in America League.
And the Yankees are probably the number two. Bob, what's the gap between those two teams and the next, I guess, best team as far as actual chances of making it to the World Series out of the American League?
Well, I think a massive gap. It's not like the National League where a bunch of teams are close. It's really two teams. But saying that, the one team I think that could surprise or be a sneaky team would be Seattle. You know, when you got a Luis Castillo, who's a stud starter, Robbie Ray, defending Cy Young winner, Logan Gilbert. Tell you what, George Kirby. That's a sneaky good team. And, you know, they were and the Astros see enough of them, but they're good, and I think they can they could shock someone in the playoffs.
Bob, as it relates to the Astros overall, we know their starting pitching has been their biggest strength, and they have been outstanding, and they could go deep as they've shown all season long. Offense has been a little bit less than what people expected, but still good, and the bullpen of late has been catching the majority of the scrutiny. As you look at this team, is the bullpen the biggest weakness where this team could fall short as it relates to the postseason?
It could be. But, you know, you could say that about a number of teams. The only thing is, you're talking scouts, it's like, well, the bottom of that order of the lineup is weak. 1 through 6, powerful. And a really big drop-off there. You need those 7, 8, 9 hitters to be able to do something. So, yeah, we'll see about, you know, Will Smith's got the postseason experience. He was lights out for Atlanta last year throughout the whole playoff race, never blew a save. So, yeah, I mean, I can see where you're saying that with the bullpen. But, you know, certainly, you know, I'll take their bullpen over bullpens like the Dodgers any day.
Well, as it relates, though, Bob, to that bottom three part of the lineup, I'm curious your thoughts nationally, because locally we saw the two trades, or the three trades, including the Smith trade you're talking about, we saw the two trades that really mattered to Astros fans first and foremost, and that was Vasquez and Trey Mancini. And the thought was, well, Trey Mancini, whether, you know, he's going to play every day, they're going to find a place for him. And then when Brantley was done for the year, the thought was, oh, he's going to fit that role of left field, and he's played there once or twice. When it comes to Vasquez, it was, well, give him some time, but he'll be the starting catcher or get more starts than Maldonado by playoff time. That hasn't happened either. What's your take on the trades and where those guys should be playing and how often?
Well, I think Mancini, you kind of mix and match type of thing, and you know, don't make him the everyday player, but you certainly see what he can do. And then the nice luxury with the Astros have with a big lead, and what Dusty can do is just say, okay, let me try this matchup. That way I know if it's going to work or not in October. I think in the catching situation, I think Maldonado was always going to be that guy just because the pitchers love throwing to him so much, and you can always, you know, replace him with pinch hitter and stuff like that. I would still expect him to start a lot of those games in October just because, you know, nothing means more than a pitcher-catcher relationship. Now, if there's someone that's just, you know, okay with Maldonado and it doesn't matter who he throws to, you know, then you might, you know, mix him in, Vasquez. But they got a great 1-2 punch there in the two catchers.
Bob Nightingale of the USA Today with us talking a little bit of baseball. To follow up on that, Bob, I was listening to an interview that Jake Arrieta was doing, and he said something along the lines of, and talking about those pitcher-catcher relationships, saying, like, look, like, big league catchers are big league catchers. And maybe there is a difference from one catcher to another as far as calling a strike zone or something like that. But I don't know. There are times where I find myself wondering if Dusty Baker is perhaps overrating just how valuable Martin Maldonado is behind the plate when Christian Vasquez is clearly an upgrade at the plate, a guy who has come through in big-time moments when he was with Boston, in particular against New York.
Yeah, I think it's very important. I really do. I don't think that Dusty is overestimating it whatsoever. I mean, remember, Greg Maddux was a Hall of Famer, but he always had his own personal catcher. Even playoff time when, you know, there were I forget who was catching him, Lopez, I think, but, you know, much better offensive catcher, but he struggled with him. You know, last year, Lucas Giolito, from May on, had his own personal catcher. So you see that a lot. I think managers really realize that importance, that, hey, that means a lot more to you than the guy who you know, may drive in a run where Maldonado doesn't. If you want, like you say, want to do that late innings, because late innings, the starting pitcher's probably going to be out anyway, that's fine. You know, maybe you do a deal where the Vasquez is catching the relievers more often just because there's going to be so many different arms anyway to get comfortable with them.
Specific catchers I can understand, and those are some good examples you gave up. What about specific, like, center fielders? Which, there was a quote a little bit ago, Bob, where Dusty Baker was talking about how for specific pitchers, he'll have specific guys in the field. I found it to be a very strange explanation. Is that something that happens more often across baseball, where a specific outfielder will be out in a game for a specific pitcher?
Not often. I mean, but usually you have a starting center fielder. I mean, I think all that shows is that the Astros don't have anybody they can trust on an everyday basis. You know, maybe they should catch Grah or something like that. But I think it's a deal where, you know, if you had a regular guy, you would not care. But the Astros have a few teams in baseball. We don't have a everyday center fielder, not one you can trust. I mean, of all the postseason teams, you know, their center field situation is probably the weakest of anybody.
Bob, when you look at it, there's been a lot of scrutiny of Dusty Baker throughout the season, and you know throughout his career, it's you know, pitching decisions. It's some of the things Paul was asking you about. But the question then becomes, with one of the hotter candidates and commodities that teams are looking at in Joe Espada, Do you see it? What's the likelihood of Dusty coming back next season? And would the Astros risk letting Joe Espada get away, who seems to be their long-term guy, if it meant bringing Dusty back for another year?
Well, I mean, Emmy could have had a spot over the years, too. I mean, nobody hired him. You know, there's been plenty of openings. There'll be plenty of openings this winter. So, I mean, there's certainly enough candidates out there if they don't want to bring Dusty back, or if Dusty doesn't want to come back. I think it's a mutual decision here. Does Dusty want to come back? He certainly deserved that. I think he was the perfect guy to replace Hinch. Never know. Espada was on that coaching staff, too, right, with the cheating scandal. So it's not like, you know, unblemished. And if he was that hard to come out of, you would think somebody would have picked him up the last couple of years, and nobody did. I mean, there's been, you know, four firings already this year. No one reached out to the Astros and said, hey, I'd like to hire him as my everyday guy.
But one of the discussions was the fact that the Astros had a behind-the-scenes conversation of, hey, you're our guy for the future, so if you kind of pull your name out of the hat, because he was a finalist for a couple jobs last year, there were teams talking to him, and suddenly it just was all cut off, to where you wondered if there was a conversation with someone with the Astros brass that said, hey, you're our guy, just be patient.
I don't think so. I don't. I mean, remember Brad Ausmus was promised that too. When Ausmus was offered the bench coach job to Dusty Baker, and they said to him, you're Dusty's heir apparent. When Dusty's time has come, you're our guy. And he didn't really, you know, believe it or say, you know what, if you do make a managerial change, I can still come there. I would still think that Ausmus would be a strong candidate as well, being the bench coach of the A's. So I don't think you can just sit back and say, oh, I'll turn these offers down. I think if you really had a major league managerial offer, you're taking it.
He is Bob Nightingale. He covers baseball for the USA Today and for Odyssey. Bob, we really appreciate your time at B Nightingale on Twitter, and we'll talk to you again soon.
All right. Sounds great. Take care, guys.
Bob Nightingale, everybody. He is Joel Blank. I am Paul Gallant in for Jeremy Branham. Congrats to Jeremy Branham on his new boy crew. Coming up next, we wrap things up. We talk to the Wheelhouse. ESPN 97.5, 92.5.
Informed opinions are always presented here. You're locked in with the Killer Bees on ESPN 97.5 and ESPN 92.5. Live from the Veritex Community Bank Studios, here's Joel Blank and Jeremy Branham.
Paul Gallant sitting in for Jeremy Branham. Congratulations to Jeremy. He has a daddy.
Well, Jake broke the news at 6 o'clock last night.
It's the circle of life.
Because we never mentioned it yesterday.
Crew, welcome to the world. Joel Blank to my left. In between Joel and I, the one, the only Jake Asman from the Wheelhouse.
Hello. Yes, Joel, we did break the news of Jeremy Branham's pregnancy on the Wheelhouse last night.
That shouldn't be allowed.
So you took credit on the crawl at the bottom of the screen, but it actually happened hours before you did it.
It said, please credit the Wheelhouse.
Yeah. Please credit the Wheelhouse. Yep. That's like when Adam Schefter blew up Tom Brady's spot when he retired.
He beat Brady to the punch.
That's absolutely ridiculous. Well, that's why Brady didn't retire. My Lord and Savior.
He came out despite Adam Schefter.
Yeah, even though he's their fellow Michigan man.
Tonight on
the
Wheelhouse is going to be Jake revealing how he selected the name of Jeremy's baby at 6 o'clock.
Crew. Yes, I gave Branham the idea years ago. It was so long ago, Paul. I don't recall the story.
I wanted to see if we could get you to spin a yarn on the fly here.
Please credit the Wheelhouse for all Branham-related
He works with Joel. Stories. He works with Joel, who grew up with the Brewers, and they were called the Brew Crew.
Right.
And all of a sudden, he just went, you know what? Crew's a great name, Jeremy. You should use it. I'll let you have it.
Years later, the baby has finally been born.
I don't think we want to credit, the Wheelhouse for all of what, you know, happens during, like, the birth of a child, but I will say this.
Or any of it, but go ahead.
Yeah, there is a show coming up next. It is called The Wheelhouse.
Correct.
Carlos Correa is back. What do you think of when you first think of Carlos Correa?
To me, he's a guy that should still be on the Astros. Maybe that's an unpopular opinion now because of Jeremy Peña and what he's done. But
that's a little sizzle to start this off.
I mean, look, the contract he signed with Minnesota is going to amount to ending up being just a one-year deal. And Carlos Correa is not here to help you in the regular season. He's here to help you in the playoffs, and this team is built to win a championship. And ultimately, they come up short, and Peña struggles in his first playoff. You know there's going to be a lot of people second-guessing the decision to not bring Correa back. Right now, it looks great. I mean, they have the best record in the American League. They're one of the favorites to win the championship. But Correa was known in this town for being one of the best playoff performers in baseball and certainly in the history of the team. So he'll get a huge reception tonight, but the true value of Carlos Correa, I think we'll find out what that really means in October.
I find it very interesting what Bob Nightingale just said, because he was the first national guy that could actually give us some insight, because we had other national guys on the show that said, we don't know because it's Houston, a bigger market, that they were offered the same kind of deal that Minnesota got. Bob Nightingale just said the Astros got the same deal and they balked on it because Jim Crane didn't like the opt-outs. And it's like, well, you know, that was a Boris thing, because Boris needed to get paid. He needed to opt out of the deal to get his old agent off the books. But to hear Bob Nightingale say that, you're like, wow, now you start questioning Jim Crane. Like, on a short-term deal, you didn't want that and have that guy you're talking about still be in your lineup.
Yeah, and with Correa, he was the first pick in the draft. He played here his first seven seasons. You know, he was a part of a team that won a championship in 17. Big hits. We all know the story of Correa. If that's the reason why they didn't want to bring him back, because Crane was worried about the opt-outs, I think you kind of check the ego at the door, no? And just say, hey, we'll deal with it for another year and worry about it next offseason when Verlander's up as well. I don't know. I mean, look, I can't argue that Peña has not been really good. He's got a higher WAR than Correa this year, but Correa's value is what he does in the postseason, and the first at-bat Jeremy Peña takes in the playoffs this year will be his first at-bat ever in the playoffs, so we'll see how he does.
Jeremy Peña of late, too, is the question, and if you take a look at this month, he's had 9 hitless games this month, and outside of that shellacking of the Chicago White Sox, you take a look at him over the last 6 games, 1 hit if you exclude that one. So I wonder if he's hitting that. I know we talk about this in football all the time, the rookie wall.
Ah, the old rookie wall.
But it is August. Mm-hmm. I feel like, if I'm not mistaken, when Carlos Correa first joined the show in 2015, I feel like there was a month or a stretch where he was similarly struggling.
Yeah.
Right, because he had a good start and then things kind of petered off before that series against the Kansas City Royals.
I mean, but you look at it, guys, and the thing that that always comes to my mind, too, is are you building it for this year or are you building it for the future? For the future, the money you're saving with Jeremy Peña may allow you to not only re-sign Verlander, but go get another bat, get a first baseman,
extend
get someone
Tucker.
You need, and extend Tucker and go long-term. But everybody in Houston knows that the most important thing, especially with how important it would be to win a second title coming off this run, would be, what are you going to do to make this team as good as it can be for 2022? And right now, I don't know if Correa, you were better off without Correa and having Peña.
You know, the big question I would have would be, all right, you didn't bring back Correa. Are you going to bring back Verlander? Because Verlander's not looking for this multi-year, 5, 6, 7, 8-year deal. He's going to be 40 years old. Will you give him 3 years? Max Scherzer just got 3 years from the Mets at $43 million.
That's his benchmark. That's everything lines up with Verlander's strikeouts, everything.
Verlander's been better.
He wants money like Scherzer.
He's been better. So will you pay Verlander that type of deal, or will you let the guy walk because, well, we got all these other great pitchers? And they do, but I still feel like there's value in bringing back Justin Verlander and giving him that type of deal. Will they pay that type of money to Verlander?
There's quality starting pitching, and there's the value of having an ace.
Yeah, the guy that's going to win the American League Cy Young Award. Like that, there's value
that's
in that, sure.
He's 39 years old, and he's pitching at this level.
Coming off Tommy John.
So I'm sure you guys are going to talk about Correa. I'm sure you guys also, you mentioned Justin Verlander. There was that piece in The Athletic talking about like the days of the negotiation between Jim Crane and Verlander. And just going off of that, I'm really curious as to what the market's going to want to give Justin Verlander, because I have a feeling, and Joel, you were saying it earlier, that like Jim Crane would probably want to match, but is there a certain point where you have to say to yourself, no, we got to stick to our process? It's one thing to pay this guy $30 million. It's another thing when he hits 40. Like, you don't know what's going to happen next. Peyton Manning fell off a cliff so quickly after the greatest season a quarterback's ever had. You got to be careful if you're going to give a guy $45, $46 million a year or so.
I agree. I just feel like, what choice do you have, though, if you're the Astros? I mean, they could say, well, we're fine with the other 5 guys we have in the rotation. We can call up Hunter Brown. But, I mean, is Verlander just going to be bad next year? Like, maybe he doesn't pitch
probably
for an ERA under 2, but
the ultimate kick in the groin would be you pay him $40-some million for a couple years, and he has another McCullers-type injury following Tommy John. And then he's out. Because when you say, what choices do the Astros have? Well, if McCullers is now proven to be back at the level he was before he got hurt, and you have Fromber, who's going to be a front-of-the-rotation guy, now you're losing something with Verlander, but you still got 2 really good front-of-your-rotation guys with McCullers and Fromber.
Agreed. You don't have to do it, but I guess a lot of it will determine how does he look in the playoffs, how does the season end. I just feel like you didn't keep Correa. You didn't keep Springer. We could go through the whole list.
Saved
of guys.
A bunch of money this last year.
Absolutely. It's like, all right, well, this guy wants to be here. This guy has a great relationship with the owner. If you got to overpay on a short-term deal, you'd rather it be on a short-term deal than a 10-year deal. I would do it, but it's not my money.
He does seem like he would be the exception to the Astros process.
Well, like I said, this is the one negotiation James Click's not going to be involved in. Yeah. It's going to be a Jim Crane-driven
and they'll do
discussion.
It on the golf course as well.
They absolutely will.
Hell yeah. Jay Gasman of The Wheelhouse.
Hello.
What's happening on The Wheelhouse coming up next?
Well, I feel like we just gave you the whole show.
I like it.
But it's actually a very special day in the history of The Wheelhouse. It is Cody Stutz's birthday
today. Oh!
Stutz!
Mr. Okay. Stutz.
What do you traditionally do on your birthday, Jay Gasman?
I'm very low-key about my birthday,
low-key.
Paul. I don't like my birthday.
You don't like it?
I don't. I don't like the attention. Like,
what?
I really don't like it.
You're
like,
a radio host. You don't like the attention?
When it's focused on like my job and talking about sports and all that, I enjoy it. But like having to like, oh, what are we doing for your birthday this weekend? I don't like the pressure of having to make plans. I'm very low key. Like, I'll get dinner with my friends. That's about it.
That's a good point. You know, I hate making plans. I like people to make the plans for me. Just tell me what to do.
Yeah, tell me where to be and I'll be there. I don't want to be like, I can't lead. I'm not a leader. I'm a follower.
Get yourself a significant other that does the planning for you.
I could do that as well, but you know, currently that is not an option.
Well, it should be.
I should
work on that.
I would.
Paul has multiple options.
Well, I would be a pushover in certain situations. Like I think there's a value to being a pushover.
With,
like
which
obviously
option?
You got to stand your ground from time to time. But if this person is pushing me over, but also making all the plans for me, and I can just be little boy Paul at age 34, man child that I am.
Well, now you know his role playing option. He likes the schoolboy Paul role whenever played. Honey,
yeah.
I've got my books and my lunch pail.
Yeah.
Want to touch my suspenders?
Suspend this. All right, so it is Cody Stutz's birthday.
How much of the Jets game did you spend?
That's a good question.
Oh, I watched every play of that preseason thriller last night, Joel.
I knew you would.
How you feeling? Mike White?
Mike White stinks, bro. Mike White stinks. I do a Jet YouTube show, and I was getting calls, with Zach Wilson down, they should play Mike White over Joe Flacco. I'm like, there's a reason why Joe Flacco's here and Mike White's not any good. Now, this Chris Streveler kid has been great in the preseason. They want Mike White dumped and Streveler to be the number three quarterback.
Hey, Jack, then Zach Wilson could check out Streveler's mom.
Is Streveler ever an attractive
mom? I don't know. It's kind of like Stifler's mom in American Pie.
Streveler's mom has got it going on.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a new song. Sweep with America. All right. The Wheelhouse is up next. Big thanks to Joel Blank, to Brendan Riley behind the glass. I am merely Paul Gallant.
Appreciate
filling
you, Paul.
In for Jeremy Branham. Jeremy Branham had a kid yesterday. Wheelhouse is next. Okay, bye.
League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.